So the first reading this morning comes from Victoria Safford. She's the senior minister at our congregation in White Bear Lake, which is a suburb of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And they just built a beautiful new building. This is a story she told in a sermon published in a wonderful book, which I now officially recommend to all of you, called The Impossible Will Take a Little While, written in 2004.
In the fall of 1988, the Pine Ridge girls basketball team played an away game in Leeds, South Dakota. It was one of those times when the host gym was dense with anti-Indian hostility. Leeds fans waved food stamps, yelling fake Indian war cries and epithets like squaw and gutter eater, gut eater. Usually, the Pine Ridge girls made their entrances according to height, led by the tallest seniors. And when they hesitated to face the hostile crowd, a 14-year-old freshman named Sue Ann offered to go first. She surprised her teammates and silenced the crowd by performing the Lakota shawl dance and then singing in Lakota, graceful, modest, and show-offy, all the same time. She managed to reverse the crowd's hostility until they even cheered and applauded. And of course, Pine Ridge went on to win the game.
The second reading is from an essay found in that same book I recommended. This is by Paxis Culta Star. What a great name that one is. An activist for a long time who, after traveling the world and living in various countries, now lives at the famous Twin Oaks community in Virginia.
The time is the winter of 1996. The place is the Bulgarian capital of Sofia. Polina is a student who has recently got involved in activism. She is 18 years old. Unlike most of the rest of Eastern Europe, Bulgaria did not throw out its communist rulers in the revolutions of 1989 and 91. Instead, some minor reforms were enacted, including some freeing of the media. In the late 1990s, the Bulgarian government is widely distrusted, disliked, and recognized as deeply corrupt. The Belene nuclear power plant is an unfinished reactor complex in the eastern part of the country. Partially built during the Cold War, it was stopped by popular protest in 1990. In December of 96, the government put together a deal with the Russians, the United States, and the European Union to complete these reactors. After a number of serious accidents, the reactor complex had been identified by the U.S. Department of Energy as one of the 10 most dangerous in the world. Polina is part of an ecological organization which is fighting against the completion of Belene. They convene a national conference to discuss how to stop this complex from being finished. Several suggestions were made appealing to alternative models for generating electricity. Finally, lastly, Polina is recognized. She says, "If you want to stop the construction of the Belene reactors, you need to overthrow the government." Remember, she is a student of 18 years old. Participants smiled politely, as if to say, "What a nice thing for a child to say." They continued talking about return on investment and various schemes. But Polina is not deterred. She goes with 20 friends to the steps of the parliament and starts a daily protest there against the government. The media thinks this is charming and puts them on TV. This is December 1996. 3 months later, in March of 97, there are 20,000 people on the steps of Parliament each day. Bowing to popular pressure, the government resigns. Shortly thereafter, the first democratic reform government is elected. A couple of months after that, they release their energy policy, canceling the Baleine project.
Been kind of warm lately, huh? I saw more people running yesterday in tank tops, shorts, some men even going shirtless, than I'm sure I've ever seen on a Saturday in January in my entire life. And we are above the equator. Below it, where it's summer, in Australia, for example, record heat and drought is stoking fires in several areas, including around Melbourne, where my friend Doug now is covering the Australian Open, one of the most important tennis events in the world. Had this event been held or scheduled just last week instead of in this one, it would have been canceled. After all, Federer can't dash around on a clay court when the temperature is in the 90s. Or the hundreds. And Ohio has broken all records for heat this year as well. And the heat is not just in our weather, but in our politics. For after getting chastised by both Vice President Al Gore and the venerable scientists who teach at the venerable, also Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. President Obama has now listed the issue of global warming, and note, he doesn't say global climate change, he's saying global warming, as one of the three central issues he hopes to tackle in his second term. And he's doing all of this as he finds ways to sideline, and I really don't know how he does it, frankly, to sideline all the ridiculous assaults on his character, policies, and person, which, as you know, have continued unabated since the day he was elected, and even starting before. I'm thinking now of the recent blast by a spokesman for a conservative religious organization who sarcastically suggested that he take his oath next week not on the Lincoln Bible or the Martin Luther King Bible, but on Das Kapital, Karl Marx's book. Baiting and name-calling. It's a well-honed practice here in the States, I think. We're really good at it. Yesterday, a member of this congregation, Victoria Parks, sent me a poem she had written, which referred to recent tragic events here in this country, but also in a country far, far away. Writing of the children killed in Connecticut by a man with a gun, and the children who were just as equally killed, but rather not here, but in Islamabad, in Pakistan, where over 178 children were killed by pilotless U.S. drones. She writes that one set of the children, the first set we memorialize, but the others we are told to forget. Like Pavlov's dogs, she writes, we jerk our knees, our redirected focus on l'outrage du jour, served up on a silver-tongued propaganda platter, told to swallow problem, action, solution, drone good, gun bad. I think she's pointing up several things here. Namely, all the things we are served up by the media, which redirect our attention towards some things and not toward other things, even though they may be very much alike in a lot of ways. And the disproportion in our own interpretations of these events. If we memorialize the children in Pakistan, like we understandably and richly did for those poor children in Newtown, would there be any outrage about those deaths in Islamabad and the use of drones, like the outrage that now has come out more clearly about how we monitor gun usage among civilians? Oh, but the world is big, you may tell me. It's huge. There's too much going on. What am I supposed to do about global warming? And Islamabad is far, far away, and I'm not even sure I could find it on a map if you open the atlas. And all these wars and these drones, all the name-calling, what can I do about that? You know, the old military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower talked about 50 years ago is even more complex now, and it's a lot bigger. What am I supposed to do about such things? The head of the NRA wants to put guns in our schools, and he yelled about it this week, all week long. Somebody could yell back, I suppose, but his organization is shored up by a mountain of money so high I can't see the top. And I am barely able to pay my mortgage, pay my dentist bill, pay my pledge to the church. What kind of power do I have? What can I do? And if that wasn't bad enough, a few months ago, that guy with the chalkboard who used to be on TV, and thankfully is no longer, Glenn Beck, told his audience to run away from any church, maybe like this one, that talks about social justice issues like war and global warming and education or healthcare or poverty or anything like that. That's a Jeremiah Wright type church. And Jeremiah Wright was just a con man. He wasn't religious. Religion is about praising Almighty God and letting God take care of things. God's got all the power. We're just weak and sinful creatures made of clay. It's hubris to say that we can do anything at all. Well, first, let me say that I have to believe that a view of God like that is one of the main reasons that atheism and agnosticism are at an all-time high percentage-wise in this famously most religious American culture. When you look around and you see poverty visibly on the streets and feel the 62-degree air on your bare January arm, or you read about wars and rumors of wars, that great phrase from the scripture, and the death of children here and there and everywhere, the God who has all this almighty power does not seem to be using it very much. And now please, before you get going, I'm not dumping on the word God. As I suggested last week, there are plenty of people, including people in this church, but especially including our own Unitarian ancestors in Poland, Lithuania, and Ukraine, the Socinians, who refuse to have faith in such an omnipotent God with power to control everything. Just for this reason, children dying, wars raging, people taking things that don't belong to them. They justly criticize the idea of an omnipotent God as bad theology. But they still use the word God to mean that deep and ongoing inspiration and accountability to truthfulness, loving kindness, and nonviolence, regardless of how others around them were using that word. And Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi both used that ancient word in precisely that manner. No, it seems to me that if there is to be justice or fairness or even charity in the world, it's got to be up to us, inspired by truth and love, if we care to use those words. But in any case, it's up to us. So the question I've been asking throughout this morning is, once all the concerns about justice have been raised, their complexities duly outlined, their urgencies acknowledged, the largeness of the situation admitted, what does it take to do justice, the work of justice? Three responses. One, justice can be achieved only if we work together. Together always offers more possibilities than alone. And organization helps, while disorganization usually doesn't. That's an old sermon, but it needs to be said again. Two, however, working together for justice often does begin with one person who gives voice to what others are only feeling on the inside, having neither the vocabulary nor the courage to speak it forth. Appreciate the inspiration of that one person. They don't grow on trees. Three, that one person does not have to be especially gifted with extraordinary wisdom, almighty power and strength, but only with the simple desire to be exactly who she is or who he is, without shame, including religiously and spiritually. Let the stories you heard this morning illustrate and maybe even confirm for you somewhat what I just said. First, one, as the ants in the children's story this morning demonstrated clearly, even if you are tiny and weigh nothing, when you work together with a cool, organized approach, much more helpful than mere fiery passion. And when you are organized carefully, each person knowing where their best gifts are best received, you can do all kinds of things no one ever thought you could do. You can do all kinds of things you never thought you could do. Two, as the story of Polina of Sophia demonstrated clearly, one person may at first simply appear to be cute. Oh, isn't that an interesting thing she said? Maybe someone a little daft or amusing. put her on TV. Isn't that adorable? But within months, 3 months, that's all, 20,000 people were doing the same thing she was doing daily. No one describes Polina as begging people to go with her or shaming them because they were not doing as much as they or as much as she thought they should be doing. She simply went and stood before the Parliament building by herself at first, then with 20 others, voiced her concerns aloud, namely that the reactor complex at Belene was being built so close to one of the main seismic fault lines in Bulgaria that an earthquake only 7 miles away, 7 miles away from Belene, had killed quite a few people just a few years before. And the plant was bankrupting the economy. It was upwards of $4 billion by that time, the cost of the thing. So besides being a danger to the health of persons and the whole countryside, it was a danger to the complete economy of a nation. Paxos Kaltastar writes that before all this happened, Polina was attending a conference where people were discussing the urgent issues and offering their answers. Finally, he writes, Polina is recognized. She's called upon. And she says, if you want to stop the construction of the Belene reactors, you need to overthrow the government. She's 18 years old, with people far older than she is, far more educated, far more experienced. Well, the government did change. They resigned after all the 20,000 kept on showing up day after day, nonviolently, I will add. The new government put a stop to the Belene complex. And then not long after, as these things happen, the government changed again. The new government reversed the former order and tried to get the complex finished again. But try as they did, they couldn't find any European investors to put money into a project that had the potential to hurt not just Bulgaria, but the Ukraine and nearby nations. Some of you may remember how far and wide the Chernobyl effects were felt. I was in Moscow just 2 months after the big Chernobyl nuclear incident, and believe me, the radiation had made a great deal of agriculture there unsafe for a time, and the farmers' market stalls set up along the pedestrian mall called the Arbat were completely empty except for a few brown cabbages. And Moscow is 700 miles away from Chernobyl, not seven. As of the spring of this year, however, because no one will give any money toward it, the Belene plant is no more, and it's being dismantled brick by brick. An act begun not by a mighty army of drones dropping bombs, but by an 18-year-old college student who voiced what others could not. 3. Sue Ann, the Lakota basketball player, was 4 years younger than Polina. Her team, all Lakota, goes to Lead, a town in South Dakota, to play a game against another school. Immediately, the locals start to taunt the visiting team in the standard racialized way we excel at so well in this country. As I said before, name-calling and baiting, our expertise. Victoria Safford summarizes, Lead fans waved food stamps, yelling fake Indian war cries, and throwing around epithets like squaw, gut eater. Sue Ann was 14. She ordinarily would have been asked to go onto the court last because of her height. She was a freshman, but she asked to be first. Refusing to be ashamed of being a Lakota young woman, she donned a makeshift traditional shawl that she had brought with her, and she came out, and she danced, and she danced, and she danced, singing in Lakota. Safford writes, "She was graceful, modest, and show-offy all at the same time. She managed to reverse the crowd's hostility until they all even cheered and applauded." Reverse the crowd by a dance, by chanting in her own native language, not by calling them names back, not by shouting at them, not by scolding them, not by pointing a gun at them. A dance and a chant, something which for the Lakota people is always a spiritual thing, an expression of both their cultural identity and their religious identity. And Lakota religion is beautiful and complex. Another example of what I was saying last week, that honest justice and honest spirituality overlap each other almost entirely, no matter what Mr. Beck thinks. There's a lot more to say, of course, about patience, about doing something because it's right, not because it's guaranteed to work. But right now, I'm calling this to a stop because despite the rain, sometime later this afternoon, I'd actually like to go out and enjoy all this warm weather.